From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It wasn't the sweeping inaugural. It was down to business. President Obama's fourth State of the Union address last night called for action on jobs, guns, climate change, immigration, action, or at least a vote. Not for bigger government, he said, but smarter, for fairness and prosperity.
It is not a bigger government we need, but a smarter government that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth.
But he knew as he spoke, he's got a divided Congress, a looming sequester, and no guarantees. This hour On Point, the President's State of the Union address and agenda, and what now? You can join the conversation. Were you with the president's message last night? With Marco Rubio's Republican pushback, will we get past gridlock? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from the White House in Washington is Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Kristen, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Also with us from WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee, John Meacham. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his American Lion about President Andrew Jackson, author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, former editor of Newsweek, currently executive editor at Random House. John Meacham, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Tom, Kristen, and John.
Kristen, big picture, what did we see last night? The president talking middle class, middle class, middle class, a long list of things to be done, but there's that Congress sitting right in front of him, and it is divided.
That's right. Well, I think you saw in the first part of this speech, at least, a President Obama who was empowered by his reelection. He called for big, sweeping things, which he would like to see get done within the next year, year and a half. Probably his best chance for getting some of these things done. Action on climate change, education, calling for universal preschool education, gun control laws, of course, called on Congress to do something to avert the sequester. And then you sort of had this speech take a sharp turn at the end, Tom, when he had that emotional sort of call for change on gun control, citing the victims who were in the audience, victims of gun violence, and he said they deserve a vote. Of course, the parents of Hydea Pendleton, that was that Chicago teenager who was shot to death after performing at his inauguration, Gabby Giffords, as well as one of the teachers from Newtown. So he really made the case that something has changed nationally, that the public mood has changed when it comes to gun control. Of course, sort of the optics significant because he is facing an uphill battle on that point. Specifically, not only a lot of Republicans, but a lot of Democrats as well who have reservations about enacting some of the new gun control measures that he's seeing. So I think there were really two components of his speech, the traditional State of the Union, but then something that we don't usually see, which is this sort of more emotional push for action on one of his key policies.
We'll look at that. It was really something. I mean, he began with this call to let's build it. And this was off of his campaign speeches. This was off of his inaugural. Let's build it around the middle class. Here's the president.
A growing economy that creates good middle class jobs. That must be the North Star that guides our efforts.
And to prod right away at the fighting that's gone on for a long time now in Congress, the president's saying there has to be an end of brinksmanship over the budget.
The greatest nation on earth cannot keep conducting its business by drifting from one manufactured crisis to the next. We can't do it.
A call to build the economy around the middle class, to have smart government involved. It won't cost, no red ink there. He said, I got to go back and look at exactly that language. But John Meacham, what did you hear in this president's sort of let's get down to business call after the inaugural before this Congress and this divided political leadership in this country?
Well, on a purely human level, I thought he seemed much more comfortable and, dare I say, relaxed in his power than he has in the previous 4 years. Now, there's nothing like a reelection to do that. But for a man who can sometimes come across as, if not hectoring, lecturing rather sternly, this was a good-spirited lecture. I thought the joke about, I know y'all love ribbon cuttings.
Right. In your district in your for new projects, even if you don't want to spend.
Perfect, and showed that he gets it. You know, he gets the game and he gets the stakes. I will say, I thought the first quotation in the speech was from President Kennedy saying, "We're not rivals for power, but partners for progress." Reminded me of Dr. Johnson's remark about second marriages. That's the triumph of hope over experience.
Yes.
So I do worry a little bit about that, but my sense is that he is using the capital he won in November in a very smart and controlled way. He's not overreaching. I did not get the sense that this was going to be able to be caricatured as a speech in which he was trying to go too far. The quotation you just played about we don't need a bigger government but a smarter government takes its place in a 30-year historical trend between President Reagan saying the government's not the solution to the problem, it is the problem, to Bill Clinton saying that the era of big government is over. Now we have what may be the third turn of that, which is not bigger but smarter. And I think a lot of us have thought for a long time that the left and right categories of the Cold War and the Civil Rights era were in fact cracking up. They didn't mean quite as much. When George W. Bush nationalizes the banks, what exactly does it mean to be right or left? I thought this was – historically we might look back at some of his language last night and think this was a turn in the political life of the country.
Not bigger but smarter, but with all that sequester and a huge budget battle right in front of us, the president saying, don't send us over any more cliffs.
Let's agree right here, right now, to keep the people's government open and pay our bills on time and always uphold the full faith and credit of the United States of America.
Jack Beatty, I think John Meacham's right. He did have a certain look of comfort up there, not exactly hectoring. It was good-spirited, but he knows what he's up against in that hall and not overreaching. I mean, maybe not, but then on any number of these things, he was kind of saying, at least give me a vote. That's
yes,
maybe no more.
Right, and that may be a miracle right by itself. You know, I really think we saw two electorates and two Americas there on the podium. You saw the president, spirited, very progressive agenda. My gosh, universal preschool, raising the minimum wage, action on climate change, on and on. And then behind him, the saturnine visage of John Boehner. And, you know, the president represents a very progressive electorate. You know, he carried 15 of the nation's largest cities, not only New York and Philadelphia and so on. He carried Houston. He carried Dallas. Meanwhile, John Boehner, what does he represent? Well, I'm quoting here from a political scientist. Following the 2010 election, the 112th House of Representatives took the biggest leap to the right in recorded quantitative measurements. That's the America John Boehner represents. Between these two, you really have a collision between this national presidential electorate and this House congressional electorate. There's no common ground there, and how they're going to work this, I don't know. You could say that the president gave a visionary speech. You could say with Mitch McConnell, false promises, that all of these were false promises, and many of them in McConnell's view. What's the point of teasing people with those things? He certainly didn't tailor his agenda to the possible. He went to the limits of the, some might say, the ideal.
Kristen, teasing here? Is that what you heard last night? Where do you see the most likely rubber meeting the road in this speech? And what looks to you like, the impossible, as Mitch McConnell might like to have it?
Right. Well, when you talk to Republicans and ask them how they heard this speech, they will tell you there was very little for them in this speech. They were roiled by the fact that he didn't acknowledge how high the unemployment rate is, by the fact that he didn't talk about the deficit. But when you look at what the president actually said, he did seem to sort of offer a potential, I want to emphasize that word, olive branch when it comes to cuts for Medicare. He called for cuts equal to what Simpson and Bowles proposed. He never gave an exact number, of course. And if you talk to Republicans, they say, well, look, we didn't hear any specifics. But when you look toward this fight that they are facing, the sequester now just a few weeks away, that is one potential for compromise. That is a place where the rubber might meet the road. But again, Republicans still saying, look, he didn't talk enough about the issues that we care about, the deficit, the high unemployment rate.
And even there, it was interesting, the president saying, we shouldn't keep promises make promises we can't keep, but must keep the promises we've already made, talking here on Medicare and more.
I am open to additional reforms from both parties, so long as they don't violate the guarantee of a secure retirement. Our government shouldn't make promises we cannot keep. But we must keep the promises we've already made.
Jack, can this government keep the promises it's already made and get anything like a deficit under control?
Well, the president argues that cuts, some reforms, and I think Kristen is right, these concessions on changing the formula of Medicare and so on, we can get to the point where, as I think he puts it, we stabilize the debt. Now, that's not eliminating the debt. Mm-hmm. That's not balancing the budget. That's stabilizing the debt. Now, Republicans don't like that. They say, and I think we're going to hear from Paul Ryan very shortly, mm-hmm. a plan to balance the budget in 10 years. Not just stabilize the debt, but balance the budget. That's what they want. So I think economists have said, yes, if we could stabilize the debt at whatever, 65% of GDP or whatever it is, that would be good. It wouldn't be ideal. But the president is saying, wouldn't that be terrific if we could get there? And the president and the Republicans say, no, we want a balanced budget. We want lower debt.
And, of course, there is a huge gulf between something called stable and something that is balanced. That's a much more aggressive path that we may see laid out even today. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the President's State of the Union address last night and the agenda that it put before Congress and the country, what we heard there, and what may come next. Kristen Welker is with us. White House correspondent for NBC News joins us from Washington. From Nashville, Tennessee, John Meacham is here, former editor of Newsweek, now executive editor at Random House, author of American Lion and Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Our own Jack Beatty's here. A couple of polls of the speech last night. The president talked a lot about the middle class, and here was his big theme on jobs.
Every day, we should ask ourselves three questions as a nation. How do we attract more jobs to our shores? How do we equip our people with the skills they need to get those jobs? And how do we make sure that hard work leads to a decent living?
There, for jobs and a living and the middle class, and everything kind of packaged in behind that. But at the other end of the speech, as Kristen said, that emotional call, the Capitol was full of families of victims of gun violence from Newtown and Chicago and more. They stood. The place was in high emotion as the president came to his sort of peroration here on let's do something on guns, at least a vote.
The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote.
Kristen, that was a moving moment in the hall. Speak to that and then go right to it. I mean, even in his own party, he's got some resistance on this front.
That's right. It was a moving moment, a memorable moment. It was certainly a break from past State of the Union addresses. We're not used to seeing sort of an emotional crescendo like this. And part of the strategy here, I think, was to tap into the fact that there is this fierce opposition. The president has called for a number of new laws, including reinstating the ban on assault weapon, limiting high-capacity magazines, and universal background checks. And if you actually talk to members of Congress, there's not a whole lot of support for a lot of those measures. It is thought that the best measure that has a chance of getting through, the universal background checks. But even amongst some Democrats, Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Harry Reid, Max Baucus, they don't like this idea of reinstating the assault weapons ban. They're skeptical of limiting high-capacity magazines. So the president knows that this is an uphill battle. He probably has a much better chance of getting something passed on immigration. But remember, there is a time factor here. The president knows he really has about a year, year and a half to get something done before the national focus shifts to the midterm elections. So that is part of the reason why you saw this emotional pitch.
John Meacham, what does that divided Congress, even within the president's own party on gun control, set up against all the emotion in the hall last night, all the deaths we've seen, the killings, Gabby Gifford standing there. What does that tell you about where our center of gravity is?
Well, I think the brilliance of what the president said was that he wanted to vote. He didn't say he necessarily expected a victory. And I think that that was an I don't know who in the White House thought of that, but they deserve a free lunch today because it was a really effective thing to say because who who can argue when you're in, you know, you're the heart of the American democracy, the people's house. You're in the place where we are supposed to go and settle our public business. Who can argue with a straight face that you shouldn't at least have the courage of your convictions, if you are a representative or a senator, to vote on what is clearly an issue of what I would argue national security, the security of children, the security of civilians, the security of one of their own, for God's sake. I mean, Gabby Giffords is shot in the head because she's at a supermarket talking to constituents and you can't get a piece of legislation to the floor. I mean, that's a kind of argument, it seems to me, that resonates quite powerfully, because if, in fact, those who have a pro- – I mean – Frankly, I am a gun owner. I hunt, although the safest thing to be is a quail near me when I'm hunting, because I'm very bad at it. But that said, I cannot imagine the case. I reject out of hand the case for assault weapons and these high capacity magazines, which have clearly one purpose. And it's, you ask about the center of gravity. The center of gravity with people I talk to, and I am a Southerner and a hunter, is we don't need what General McChrystal calls weapons of war in the streets of the United States. And I think as if that case is made, and he clearly intends to keep making it, and the broad point made in such a stage as the State of the Union is you're not going to have the courage to come to this floor and vote on it, I think that's a very powerful position for a president to take.
But, Jack, here we are, all that emotion, and the president's calling for a vote. Now, yes, but that's kind of pale medicine, because it sounded almost as though that's all he expects. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, it may be. And, you know, look what's the cautionary note there. He has Democratic senators up for re-election in states like Alaska, Arkansas, South Dakota, Montana, Louisiana, Iowa, West Virginia. This is rural America. This is red state America. This is that other America that didn't vote for the president. And there, the National Rifle Association has had successful fear campaigns over the years. They're probably going to run a big one now, funded by gun manufacturers. So it's going to be the Democratic senators in those states don't want to take any tough votes. And but we have a situation here where for background checks, it's almost unanimous. 90% of the public wants it. And yet if you break that down and you tell Republicans that Obama wants it, their support of it goes from 60-something percent down to 30-something percent. In other words, for Republicans, they like the idea of background checks, but if you tell them Obama wants it, they don't want it.
All right, to our listeners, they're looking very closely at the list of initiatives the president would like to see acted on. They're also looking at realities on Capitol Hill and around the country. Dave in Lexington, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi Jack. I'm a liberal Democrat, and I liked most of what the president said, but I'm very worried that he's going to squander his political capital on immigration the way George W. Bush squandered his on Social Security and a couple of other issues. The American people do not want immigration reform. A Pulse Opinion Research poll earlier this year found that we oppose it 52-33%. For Democrats, it's not surprising, or it shouldn't be surprising. We have 20 million people out of work, and what, we're going to legalize half that number? If he did pass the comprehensive immigration reform, it would undermine everything he's trying to do on the environment, because the average immigrant's greenhouse gases rise fourfold after arrival in the United States, because most of them come from tiny ecological footprint countries.
Hey, Deva, take your point. On the other hand, they're already here, and that's a lot of what the president and others are trying to deal with. But what about it, Kristen Welker? On this and more, squandering capital? I mean, this is not in the first term. You know, he could challenge Congress to do things, and if they didn't, his revenge could be to turn around and run against them on that and re-win the White House, retake the White House, which he did. This time, it's either action or what's the point? You know, where's the squandering? Where's the real opportunity?
Well, it seems like there's more concern that he might squander political capital when it comes to gun control, because what you have right now is a real push in both parties for immigration reform. You have a bipartisan group of senators working on this, and perhaps sort of the most energy to get something done on this issue that we've seen in years, in part because of the 2012 election, which, of course, saw Latino voters come out in large proportions for President Obama and the Republican Party taking a step back and saying, we really need to look at this issue if we want to be viable in future national elections. So I think that when it comes to political capital, there is more of a concern that he might waste it on something like gun control, which is really facing more resistance. You noticed last night the president was very measured in his remarks about immigration. He didn't get into specifics, in part because there is a plan coming together that's being formed within Congress. And I think that the president was hesitant to step on the progress that is being made there. He gets the sense that this is moving forward. So in terms of political capital, I think that the White House Democrats less concerned about him wasting it on immigration reform. They see this as something that actually can get through.
And of course, the Republicans putting up Marco Rubio for their response to the president's speech. Rubio from an immigrant family himself, and one of those senators who's been talking about it, taking some flack in the party about that. John, what do you think on immigration? Does the president have the right kind of tone and tack here to push something through?
This has been one of the most surprising things to me in the past, I guess, 6-8 weeks, is how uncontentious this has tended to be. It feels as though the parts are falling into place for a kind of bipartisan deal. And I don't think the president will be using a great deal of capital on this. I think it is interesting, to go to Kristen's point, that he is he's clearly intending to at least set out to spend more on the gun question. And if I can just say one thing about the linguistics of this, politics is a lot about this. When we talk about gun control, I think people go back to those first debates in 35 years ago now, I guess, which was about handguns. You know, there was kind of a reflexive liberal position. We have to take all handguns away. And that helped drive the NRA farther to the right and make it more powerful. What's really being discussed here is the demilitarization of our civilian life. It's taking military-style weapons and military-style magazines away from American streets. And I think there is more openness to this in those rural states, in those red states, than a lot of people give credit for when the argument is made most clearly. I'd argue there's more support for that than there is for universal background checks, frankly, because people who own guns understand what different kinds of guns are intended for. And now that the president has chosen to embrace this, you know, for him, he wants Newtown to be the Selma of voting rights. The Newtown will be to guns what Selma was to the Voting Rights Act. You know, in 1965, when Lyndon Johnson said there are some places where history and fate intersect, Lexington and Concord, Appomattox, Selma, Alabama. Will Newtown finally be the place that is the tipping point, to use that overused phrase, in the political conversation? I don't know, but I do know that Bill Clinton tried it. He passed it. It was allowed to lapse. And I admire the president for spending capital on that question.
A Newtown-Selma parallel. We'll look at that and more. Jack Beatty, what do you think? Newtown-Selma? Parallel power there?
Well, of course, when at the time of Selma, Lyndon Johnson had a Democratic majority in both houses, and he had a moderate wing of the Republican Party who really put across the Voting Rights Act. That doesn't exist with regard to guns. Yes, there is. I'm sure what John says is true, that many hunters and people who know about guns realize these military weapons are not needed and that there's something sort of almost obscene about them. On the other hand, it is very much easier for the National Rifle Association to get at the idea they're going to come and get your guns if they pass a ban on a kind of gun, even if your gun is grandfathered in. I mean, it's the slippery slope, and look what they're doing. So I think that one is a tough reach for these red state senators. But, you know, already gun control experts say, just with the executive orders the president has issued, we've already moved a good deal ahead of where we were. And if we can do the background checks, too, and close that gun show loophole, that will really be significant progress. And, you know, when you have Republican congressmen saying we've got to look at the gun show loophole, that I think is pretty significant.
The families of Newtown deserve a vote, said the president in his State of the Union, and of Aurora and of Oak Creek and of Tucson and Blacksburg, going right back. Elizabeth in Springfield, Illinois, is calling. Hi, Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My reading of the Second Amendment says that for a well-regulated militia, which means we don't need every Tom, Dick, and Harry armed, I have lost 4 students over the years. And some of them were just with regular guns, and there was no mental health. It was just, let me show you my father's gun. It accidentally went off, and my student was killed. We really need to take guns away from people. Hunting is fine if you're going after animals, not human beings. But countries that have fewer guns per 100 population or 100,000, whatever you want, have less homicides and less suicides by guns.
But do you think the country's ready to take guns away, even take the steps that the president's proposing that are kind of on the table here now?
I think we have to. And listening to NPR the other day, who runs the National Rifle Association, it's the gun manufacturers. We really need to get them out of the mix.
Elizabeth, I'm happy for your call. I appreciate it. Kristen, I don't know. I'm not sure how you're ranking the two or three most likely things to get motion here, but how would you rank them?
Well, in terms of what the president has proposed, I think the toughest thing to get through is going to be reinstating the assault bans weapon. I think limiting high-capacity magazines is going to be tough. I think that universal background checks is something that there seems to be a fair amount of support for. And I would just note that one of the things that the White House is looking at, the polling numbers that are coming out right now, which are really so different than what we've seen in the past, there really does seem to be a broad base of support to get something done on this issue. So President Obama certainly tapping into that last night in his State of the Union address, but he has been on the road, will continue to be on the road this Friday. He'll be in Chicago talking about this. And this is one of the tactics that this White House has taken. President Obama going out, talking to people, pressuring Congress really by building up support in the court of public opinion. And that is something that I think you're going to see in the coming weeks. One point that I just want to touch on also that, that Elizabeth mentioned is the idea of keeping weapons out of the hands of the people who shouldn't have them and essentially expanding services to those who are in need of mental health care. And I think that that's one of the other tactics that there seems to be broad bipartisan support for. So I think that you're going to see the White House and Congress really try to improve that, as well as take a look at just the culture of this country that does to some extent glorify gun violence.
John, just a half a minute before the break, but a work with me message last night or I'm coming after you with American public opinion message from the president?
Well, on a couple, you know, on a couple of issues, he said, if you don't do something, I will, which was is uncharacteristic for Obama in many ways. But I think on the gun question, he was saying, look, I've got emotion on my side, and I may have public opinion on my side, so don't think this is going to be a reiteration of an old drama.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the president's State of the Union address and agenda, what we heard last night. And what now with John Meacham, author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power and American Lion, about President Andrew Jackson, former editor of Newsweek. Kristen Welker is with us, White House correspondent for NBC News. Jack Beatty's here. And, of course, there was the president last night saying, look, I'm laying out a lot of stuff here, but it won't increase our deficit by a single dime.
Tonight I'll lay out additional proposals that are fully paid for and fully consistent with the budget framework both parties agreed to just 18 months ago. Let me repeat. Nothing I'm proposing tonight should increase our deficit by a single dime.
Not by a single dime, but he did have proposals that would cost employers something and maybe put some more change in the pockets of working people. Here he was asking for a minimum wage that would rise automatically along with the cost of living.
Let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour.
$9 an hour, and here was Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, Republican, with the Republican response to the president's address.
More government isn't going to help you get ahead. It's going to hold you back. More government isn't going to create more opportunities. It's going to limit them. And more government isn't going to inspire new ideas, new businesses, and new private sector jobs. It's going to create uncertainty.
Let's go to Carl in Nashville. Carl, you're on the air.
You know, first of all, I think that as journalists, they've been kind of lazy. The journalists in this country have been kind of lazy because they let the Republican Party off the hook when they claim that they're deficit hawks and they want to do something about their fiscal hawks, their deficit hawks. Well, where were these people when Bush, when the Republicans had the White House, the Senate, and the House, and they were spending like drunken sailors? They were nowhere to be found.
Well, that's true, but they say they've changed. They voted the Tea Party in. The Tea Party's, you know, crusading for cuts. What about now, Carl?
I think the journalists need to call them out, really. And I believe in the president. I believe the president need to get out of Washington. I'm a Obama supporter. And if he spent more than 2 weeks in Washington, D.C., I think he needs to be impeached because there's nothing that the House of Representatives is going to do. Case in point, I'm listening to a Republican talk show this morning, and the host asked a congressman here in Nashville, asked him just a softball question. Well, what about the minimum wage? This guy said he wouldn't support raising the minimum wage. Now, if you're not going to support the president on raising the minimum wage and having more people, more money in their pockets, then you're not going to support him for anything.
I've got it, Carl, but in the end, the roads come back to the House. I mean, they vote or they don't. He's got some executive power, but it comes back to Capitol Hill. We'll look at that, the minimum wage and more. Kristen, what about the, here's my proposal, list of proposals. They will not increase the deficit by a single dime. What did that mean exactly, Kristen?
Well, I would make a couple points. First of all, Republicans heard that. They were quite skeptical. The president mapped out a number of things he would like to see happen, including expanding universal early childhood education to all kids throughout the country. And Republicans say, well, how are you going to pay for it, as well as investing in manufacturing, new infrastructure projects? So that right away sort of raises a big question
mark.
What
did he mean, though? Does it mean he's going to raise more revenue? Is that where the balance would come there? Or how does the president think he would do that?
Well, he wasn't specific, of course, but that is the idea, and that would also, to some extent, come from pre-existing funds that are being misspent. But the president wasn't specific about how he intended to pay for these projects, so I think that is one of the issues that Republicans are taking issue with. On the point of the minimum wage, this is such an interesting idea. It polls very well. People like it. It's a strong middle-class idea.
The president said Mitt Romney was for it, citing
Mitt
a comment
Romney
he made in New Hampshire. Yeah.
Right. And when you talk to some folks in the House, they will say the reason why they don't think this will get through is because it could potentially wind up costing jobs. In other words, if you're paying some folks more, then there are fewer jobs available, ultimately hurting middle class Americans in the long run. So that is their argument. So that's where I think you're going to see the battle lines being drawn. But again, the president mapping out these ideas that poll very well and that people really like. So I think that this is going to be tough moving forward because people do want to see some of these things get passed, investments in infrastructure, manufacturing.
I mean, it does make you cringe when the president describes how, you know, households with two working adults at minimum wage would be living in poverty. On the other hand, we know that kind of argument that gets made. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Steve.
Tom, I'm surprised with the president making a pitch for raising the minimum wage. I mean, I know that everyone loves to talk about the middle class. That's all I seem to be hearing. But we all know that with Obamacare, small employers are reticent to hire people. And if you raise the minimum wage, it's going to hurt the young, the unskilled, the unemployed, because small employers, and President Obama should know this, are having trouble keeping their payrolls already, and all of a sudden if you tell them, well, we've got to pay people more, they're just not going to hire these people, so it's going to hurt the poor more than anybody.
Jack Beatty, what do you say to that argument? It is rolled out by no small number of economists. On the other hand, the president's numbers about working people in poverty, they hurt when you hear them.
They sure do, and it seems like a disgrace. It's a repudiation of the work ethic. On this question of does this, in fact, put headwinds in for jobs in retail, the National Retail Foundation today says it does. Well, the president's economic advisor is Alan Krueger. At Princeton, he did a lot of research on this, and his findings about past minimum wage increases is that that is not so. It does not cost jobs, or if it does, it's just at the margin. Now, I don't know if that's beyond dispute in economics. These are published articles. So he's got some foundation there, some evidence that trade-off isn't necessarily so. And when you just consider what the minimum wage would be, I mean, if we were back to 1968 levels, if the minimum wage had been adjusted for inflation since 1968, it would be $10.51 now. And it hasn't. And, you know, even the president in the 2008 campaign, he wanted $9.50. Now he's down to $9. He's actually come down. It's the kind of argument that does appeal to work ethic, pull yourself up by your bootstraps straps argument appeal. And so I hope for the sake of people who are struggling, it would be a great thing, it seems to me, if we could do it.
Yeah, though, there's that argument that small business may employ fewer people. I don't know. It's hard to see that stand up against. At the same time, we know a lot of big corporations have a lot of money just stashed, just in cliffs, set aside right now. There's a gulf. Let's look abroad for a minute. We're talking about war. The president was last night, so we're going to bring this war in Afghanistan to an end, and we're going to bring home more troops soon.
Tonight, I can announce that over the next year, another 34,000 American troops will come home from Afghanistan. This drawdown will continue, and by the end of next year, our war in Afghanistan will be over.
John Meacham, can you just declare a war over like that? Can you just say it, and so?
Sure. he certainly can. And I think a lot of people remember during Vietnam used to say, declare victory and go home.
Yeah.
I think the question of whether it is a wise declaration will come in 15 and 16 and 17 and whether terrorism begins to find a base in Afghanistan again. It is remarkable historical moment, though. If President Obama had not won a second term, historically, he would have gotten enormous credit for two things for which he received very little real-time political credit. One was the rolling up Iraq and bringing that to a close, and the other was avoiding more of a economic crisis in 2009. Contemporary politics gives you very little credit for things that do not happen. History tends to give you more credit for that in the fullness of time, and I think it's quite remarkable that we have continued now for 11 years to fight this war of different types in Afghanistan, first counterterrorism, then counterinsurgency. And it's an interesting reminder that it's been a fundamentally undemocratic way of projecting power. So few of us have direct connections to those who are doing the actual fighting that it's a sadness in a way that the country has to be reminded that we are at war and that a war will be ending at the end of next year. And I think that's something that going forward in a difficult world, we're going to have to spend a lot of time thinking about before we engage at that level again around the world.
Though it's not like people don't know people who have made that sacrifice. I'm staring at my director right through the glass here, his sister home from Kandahar. I mean, Jack, there was a little bit of mission accomplished, I thought, in the president's depiction. Well, we will have, you know, the Taliban, I mean, the Al-Qaeda leadership will be taken care of. This will be over. We'll be out of there. Much, much, much more modest kind of presentation. But I wondered what the military men in the audience last night were thinking as he described all these accomplishments that would accompany that end of the war.
Yes, and when he talked about, yes, we have pushed back al-Qaeda, he had to add, on the other hand, al-Qaeda-affiliated groups do seem to be running rampant in North
Africa. And everywhere, yeah.
So that was a bit of a contradiction, and I think, you know, thinking of John Brennan's testimony last week, this proposed CIA director, about the and all the talk about the drone program, the president's quotation from a Burmese dissident really struck me. He said, "There is justice and law in the United States. I want our country to be like that." Well, of course, many people look at the drone assassination program and say, "Is that, you know, complete, you know, the president deciding on his own, justice, you know, judge, jury, and executioner to kill people? Is that American justice and law?"
But, and last night, of course, he talked about other measures and how he'd like to get more law around. He didn't say drone, but presumably, Kristen, that's what he was talking about. Yet he's been saying that for some months, and we haven't seen more clear legal structure around the drone program.
Absolutely. This has been something that has dogged the Obama administration for the past several weeks, really, when it came to light that they had this justification for using drones to target American citizens. They've been asked a lot of questions about this, playing defense on this front, making the case that they don't take these actions unless they can really minimize any collateral damage, unless they're absolutely sure of their target. I want to just go back to the point about Afghanistan quickly. You talked about the end of the war in a year, and there's still a big question mark about what that's going to look like. The president announced last night that 34,000 troops will be home from Afghanistan within a year. That's about half the number that are there right now. There are about 66,000 troops there right now. And there's still a big question mark surrounding how many troops will be left after 2014. That's something that the president, this administration, is working on with the Afghan administration, trying to determine. There's a lot of concern among the military ranks that withdrawing troops too quickly could leave Afghanistan in a vulnerable position. So that's still something that's being negotiated. And so when we hear the president say that the war will come to an end, there's still a lot of questions surrounding how many troops will actually be on the ground still once that happens.
Let's really bring it home to education, preschool education. The president's saying we've got to start educating our kids from a four-year-old high-quality preschool level to be competitive in the world.
We know this works. So let's do what works and make sure none of our children start the race of life already behind. Let's give our kids that chance.
Talk about children right there, and talk about children in the context of climate change. Here's the president.
For the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change.
Let's pick up both of those. I mean, Kristen, first on education and this balanced budget. How do you add that and balance? It's a great idea, but here again, I'm just wondering, where does the president come up with the money to do it?
That's right. Where does he come up with the money? He didn't say what it would cost and where specifically he would come up with the money. But by some estimates, it would be about twice as much as what taxpayers are paying right now. So the president making the case, look, if we get our deficits under control, we can afford to make these types of improvements and changes. But there is a lot of skepticism that that is actually going to be possible without someone bearing the cost, taxpayers, namely.
And climate change, Jack, I mean, there's a huge issue when it comes to the future. The president's saying we can't avoid this. If we don't act on this, other countries will get ahead of us on clean energy. But what about action? More executive authority to be exercised there, or something from Congress, Jack?
I think he's got to go the executive authority route, and I can imagine Harry Reid telling him we do not want to vote on any kind of climate change legislation in the Senate, not with those senators in those rural states. And I didn't name all of them, North Carolina. You know, and Kay Hagan does not want to have to vote on a cap and trade bill or anything even like it. So I think the executive, the Supreme Court gives him that leeway, and I think they'll probably proceed there.
John, I was, I have to say, personally moved last night when he talked about cleaning up voting so that people didn't stand in line forever. And of all the guests in the hall, I mean, there were many who were moving on the gun death front, definitely. But Desalene Victor, the, what is it, 102-year-old from Florida who waited hours to vote and was there in the hall last night. I mean, just love her. He's going to have a commission set up with what his former legal counsel and that Romney's campaign legal counsel working to see how we clean up the voting process in this country. But even there, is there consensus behind getting something done there, John?
Well, you know, this is one of those critically important constitutional, fundamentally democratic, lowercase d issues that immediately gets translated into partisan paintball. And so Republicans believe that this is all a democratic, uppercase D plot to get more of their voters in. Democrats believe that Republicans on voter ID, picture ID, are trying to suppress the vote. I think there is some room, and there should be some room for a common sense reform. I think that we learned with Simpson-Bowles that we can get a report that people like even if no one does anything about it. And so perhaps there is some room for that. It's sort of shocking when you really think about it at this juncture, to go back to Selma briefly, mm-hmm. you know, 50 years on, that this is – we're still debating whether, you know, how we handled the actual fundamental act of democracy, which is voting.
Voting right there and budgeting right behind it, and that's right in front of us. Kristen, you know, John Boehner may not have stood up much, but there was some decorum in the hall last night. How long until we get into the sort of bloody trenches of sequester and all the rest?
Oh, I think it's going to start right away. Just a few minutes ago, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell came out responding to the president's State of the Union. We spent so much time talking about the minimum wage just a few minutes ago, and McConnell kind of took a shot at the president. He said he spoke of workers' minimum wages instead of their maximum potential. So
there's the chasm right in front of us. Kristen Welker, John Meacham, Jack Beatty, thanks to you all. This is On Point.